At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There is a pretty good chance that tomorrow at this time, the business news is going to consist of three little letters, G, D, and P. We get the government's last best look at second quarter gross domestic product in the morning. And for all the talk of recession, economic growth's probably going to be better than expected, in part because we, you and me, we're buying more stuff. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday today, the 27th of August. Good to have you with us, as always. More of us were buying couches and computers last month than the experts had been guessing. The Commerce Department told us today orders for what are called durable goods rose almost 1.5% in July. That's a pretty good jump the way things have been going. And those higher estimates for tomorrow's last report on Q2 gross domestic product are a result. But real estate prices are still in the dumps. The stock market is stuck. So investment banks and private equity firms are looking for places to spend their money. Maybe all they need to do is look out the window, because by one estimate, financially strapped cities and states need $1.5 trillion to fix up our crumbling bridges, roads, and utility plants. Taxpayers have traditionally been hit up to pay for those kinds of projects, but Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports governments are increasingly heading for some big Wall Street names like KKR and JP Morgan to get the job done.
Next month, the Pennsylvania legislature decides whether it will earn $13 billion by leasing the nation's oldest toll road, the Pennsylvania Turnpike, to private investors. Florida and Chicago are asking for bids on a highway and an airport. I asked Steve Steckler of Infrastructure Management Group, why would local governments want to turn their infrastructure over to private operators?
Because the fact is their assets may be more valuable in someone else's hands. Someone may be able to manage the facility more efficiently, market it more effectively. It's the same equation whether you're dealing with a public or a private entity.
But Robert Puentes at the Brookings Institution asks, why can't local governments run those projects just as efficiently? He thinks they have another motive.
We know that there is considerable reluctance to raising gas taxes or highway tolls to pay for infrastructure. So in some ways, this could be a way to outsource the raising of transportation revenues from the public to the private sector.
Investment banks and private equity firms have amassed some $250 billion to spend on public infrastructure, but Steve Steckler says it'll be a while before that happens.
The amount of money that has been raised to this point vastly exceeds the volume of deals out there into which the money can be placed.
But that could change as governments consider leasing water and sewer projects, electricity plants, even prisons and college dormitories. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The weather is very much on the minds of a lot of people along the Gulf Coast. The latest forecast for Tropical Storm Gustav has it making landfall there Monday morning sometime. The predicted track's not specific as to where it's going to hit, but oil traders weren't taking any chances. Crude jumped almost $2 today on fears Gustav will hit oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. Buddy Bolfras is an engineer and longtime oil rig worker down in Texas. We got him on the phone earlier today to ask what oil companies worry about as they get ready for a storm.
Usually, there are enough platforms producing out there that the path of the hurricane makes 10 to 20% of them shut down. So that in itself doesn't really affect oil prices much.
But of course, it all depends on how big the storm finally gets. Predictions for Gustav are to be a Category 3.
If we had a Katrina where it really got heavy and it destroyed pipelines and slowed things down and came on shore in Mississippi and hurt the refineries, now you're talking about gasoline prices.
If residents of the Gulf Coast are nervous about what might happen, Germans are tense over what's going on right now. Confidence in Europe's largest economy has plummeted, perhaps because that economy actually shrank in the second quarter. Stephen Beard reports now from the Marketplace European Desk in London.
Many European economists say that Germany will slip into a recession by the end of the summer. That may afford Americans some wry amusement. Graham Mather is with the European Policy Forum.
The Germans have been claiming that their export-led, highly manufacturing-based economy was coping with world difficulties better than financial and service-driven economies like the United States. It now looks as though they weren't doing all that fantastically.
But, say the analysts, don't gloat at Germany's misfortune. The effects of it are already rippling across the Atlantic. Stefan Richter is publisher of the online magazine The Globalist. He says a downturn in Europe's largest economy will bring lower Eurozone interest rates, and that prospect has cut the value of the euro against the US currency.
The dollar is strengthening, and that undermines the boost that U.S. exporters had recently just from exchange rate effects with a weak dollar and a very strong euro.
American exports to Germany account for only a tiny fraction of U.S. GDP. But, says Richter, a German recession could easily drag down the rest of Europe, and that would hit the global economy.
The stronger Europe is, the more global boost will there be for growth. So everything hangs together, and the better Europe does, the better the U.S. will do.
In other words, he says, forget America's schadenfreude and hope that Germany's angst disappears soon. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
High hopes over gross domestic product couldn't counter rising oil on Wall Street. Today, we will have the details when we do the number. I had to ask a colleague today to figure this one out for me, but here goes. In Korean, Ladies Professional Golf Association sounds something like this. Yoja Progolpu Hyopwe. There, I did it. I mention that because a lot of the LPGA's top players are South Korean, and from now on they're going to have to learn some English. The LPGA is telling all its players they're going to be suspended if they can't pass an oral English exam next year. Tournaments have a hard time attracting sponsors without English-speaking stars. And Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports those sponsors speak a language everybody understands. It's called money.
The LPGA says it's just trying to help players with their professional development. But the official explanation has been lost in translation.
It's very U.S.-centric and jingoistic.
That's Smith College economics professor Andrew Zimbalist. He says the LPGA's new policy is driven by tournament sponsors who only care about the bottom line.
It sends out a message that the LPGA is about packaging a product and it might or might not have good golfers.
The LPGA could not accommodate an interview request, but Lake Forest College economist Robert Boddy says sports is mostly about entertainment these days. He says the LPGA had no choice.
They're doing exactly what it is that other professional sports leagues have done, which is to make, I think, their sport more attractive to their primary audience.
J.S. Kang is a sports agent who represents six Asian golfers. He's Korean-American and sees no discrimination. He says his players understand English will help them. He ticks off ways they can make money on and off the golf course.
endorsements, appearances to play in pro-ams or charity events or in some corporate events.
Kang says players know they'll never be the next Tiger Woods if they don't get in the swing of things and get comfortable enough with English to be successful product pitchmen. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
When talk turns to the economy this fall as the election heats up, at some point you're going to hear either Barack Obama or John McCain, or maybe both of them, talk about how small businesses create as much as 80% of the new jobs in this country. That's a political point that has the added benefit of being true, according to the Small Business Administration. What you're probably not going to hear, though, is the flip side of that coin, also from the SBA, that more than half of all new small businesses don't make it past their first 5 years. But petering out isn't the only danger for those new companies. If they're good at what they do, and if their very first product is a smash hit, they have to learn how to grow, and grow fast, and not flame out. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Mitchell Hartman reports.
This is a story about when opportunity comes knocking. Marie Osmondson was an accountant and suburban homemaker until she tested out a recipe she'd made up for veggie burgers at a family birthday party. Friends liked them so much, they convinced her to start a business. A year later, Osmondson had scratched out a few inches of shelf space for her frozen veggie patties in some local grocery stores. She was producing $3,000 a week, more or less on her own. Then she got a call.
They wanted 30,000 patties by the end of the week.
They is Burgerville, the dominant regional fast food chain with 39 locations in Oregon and Washington. Burgerville had pulled all its Garden Burgers off the menu. Kellogg's, which owns Garden Burger, issued a voluntary recall. Suddenly, Osmondson had all their Burgerville business.
So I called on family and friends, and everybody showed up, and it was just chaos here trying to get everything done. But we did it.
Now, just 3 months later, Osmondson's company, Chez Gourmet, has 10 employees. She's producing 40 to 50,000 patties a week, mostly for Burgerville. Oregon State University's Food Innovation Center gave Osmondson technical help. Susan Massoni is the director. She's seen lots of startups faced with this dilemma, how to grab a lucky break and turn a one-person kitchen table business into a full-blown enterprise.
Mostly what we see is people giving up. So they may be able to distribute through farmers markets, and then all of a sudden one of the local groceries said, hey, people are asking for your product, and that may become a stumbling block. Sometimes those stumbling blocks end up being roadblocks.
Osmondson is driving full speed ahead at her roadblocks. She's going after new business, and she's moving into a new production facility that's 10 times the size. She's taking some big chances.
It's been fairly risky. I've had family invest in my business, which has been extremely helpful. Credit, establishing credit with some of the vendors has been a challenge because, of course, they don't want to take a risk with you when you don't have any history.
And she does face one big risk. A Kellogg's spokesperson says Garden Burger's quality problems are solved and it wants Burgerville's business back. If it succeeds, the food giant will eat Osmondson's lunch. Burgerville says it's still considering its options. Osmondson does have one thing on her side. Burgerville says customers like her patties. She's selling them in stores, too, as well as from the front office of her little factory.
Let me get some sweet and sour sauce for you, and you can take it.
Oh, thanks! This might not be enough for the wedding party.
She recently sold several boxes to Teresa Ashford for a vegetarian reception. Ashford says she fell in love with the Chez Gourmet patties when she tried them at Burgerville.
And we went in one day to get a Garden Burger, and they're like, no, sorry, you know, unavailable. We're like, what?
She tasted the patty from Chez Gourmet.
So we fell in love, definitely.
Osmondson's other advantage, ironically, is the slowing economy, which makes it easier to find new workers. She says she'll need more hands on deck as she diversifies. She wants to make a number of other veggie and vegan varieties. She's got two new flavors in the works, plus a basil mayo sauce. Just something she whipped up in her spare time in the kitchen. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
¶¶ Coming up, remember what you've heard about taking electronics in the pool?
I highly recommend go underwater.
Oh, yeah.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 0.75% today, 89 points to close at 11,502. The NASDAQ rose 0.8%, 20 points, finished at 2382. The S&P 500 picked up 0.8%, 10 points, ended the day at 1281. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae don't call it a comeback just yet, but shares in the mortgage finance giants jumped again today. The financial world seems to be more bullish this week about the two companies' prospects. Shares of Freddie rocketed almost 20% higher. Fannie spiked up 15%. Financials had a solid session. Lehman Brothers led the way on rumors that the investment bank is getting closer to a deal to sell off its asset management unit. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.77%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the preliminary second quarter gross domestic product report. Just 3 years ago, on August 28th, Mayor Ray Nagin ordered the mandatory evacuation of New Orleans in anticipation of Hurricane Katrina. And Olympic gold medal figure skater Scott Hamilton turns 50. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. That durable goods figure we started with today is a pretty straightforward indicator, stuff that's expensive and supposed to last more than 3 years. But sometimes you find better economic truths in more offbeat places. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson joins us now from Washington with the latest installment of our series on unusual indicators. Jeremy, what do you got?
Well, of all the strange indicators we've talked about, Kai, fast food sales going up, pets being returned to animal shelters, this has by far the most components. We're calling it the shrink indicator. And it's amazing what you can learn about the economy in a psychiatrist's office. Now, I went to an anxiety clinic called the Ross Center here in Washington, D.C. And if we could bring up the sound from that visit, it's very relaxing in there, as you can tell. And I spoke with Geraldine Ross and Beth Salcedo.
Maybe I should put you on the couch.
Put us on the couch.
We'll reverse roles here.
Okay.
Now, you're a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
And you're a psychologist?
A clinical social worker.
Okay, so can you tell anything about what's going on in the economy by what people are asking for, what kind of business is coming in, that kind of thing?
Well, first of all, people are talking about the economy. I mean, that's part of the therapy sessions. That's something that's affecting everybody. But also what I notice in terms of the practice is that we used to have patients mostly coming in for psychotherapy to see psychologists and social workers. What I'm finding now is that more and more patients are coming in wanting medication. And when I ask them why, one of their first things they say is because I can't afford the psychotherapy.
Dr. Salcedo, are you seeing the same thing?
Well, you know, I think it is a lot cheaper to go the medication route. And if people don't have a real strong preference for medication versus psychotherapy, they often, in times like this, will choose to do medication because they see me once. They might see me again a few weeks later, and then maybe once they're stable every few months, versus seeing a therapist every week for, you know, 12 to 16 weeks on end.
Do you think that at a time when the economy turns down and people are stretched, that they're more in need of therapy, or that this is something, this is the first thing that should go when times get tough like this?
Usually definitely more in need.
I imagine that you'll agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that I find is that a lot of the things that most of us do to deal with our everyday stress, you know, working out, eating properly, taking vacations, things like that, that's often the first thing to go when the economy begins to sink.
Now, Kai, with regards to what the doctors were saying about more people wanting medication as opposed to therapy, the numbers do seem to bear that out. Eli Lilly reported that second quarter sales of its antidepressant Cymbalta were up 26%.
Wyeth's drug Effexor was up 5%, and Forest's antidepressant Lexapro saw sales jump 6%. So maybe a whole new meaning for the term Great Depression.
Now, those are the numbers, though, but let me ask you the anecdotal question, Jeremy. You went out to the clinic to talk to these ladies, right?
That's right.
What was the waiting room like? Was it crowded or empty?
It was crowded, actually. Although, you know, a lot of those people that are coming in, according to these doctors, are not coming in to have a long therapy session. They're coming in to say, get me some Lexapro.
Jeremy Hobson in Washington for us. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Kai.
There was a big poverty report out from the Census Bureau this week. We learned another 816,000 Americans fell into poverty last year, including nearly a half a million children. Also, that after you adjust for inflation, the median household income is now $2,000 less than it was at the beginning of the decade. Those would seem to be pretty good talking points for Democrats as their convention in Denver moves into its third day today. This week, we've asked some prominent policy types in the party to give us an issue the Dems should embrace but haven't so far. Commentator Robert Reich has one. He says Democrats have acknowledged the obstacles racial minorities face in hiring and education. Now, he says, they ought to look at the economically disadvantaged, too.
Here's an idea Democrats probably won't endorse, but should. Affirmative action based on family income. The latest data from the census tell us that inequality keeps growing. Most American families are now earning less in real terms than they did in 2000. More are in poverty. Meanwhile, the super rich are taking home a larger slice of the economic pie than they have in 80 years. At the same time, it's becoming harder for lower income people to move upward. With wider inequality, the distance poor kids, whatever their color, have to climb to reach the upper middle class is much longer. And the loss of millions of manufacturing jobs has removed many rungs in the middle of the income ladder, making that climb even harder. In the new economy, education and connections mean more. Increasingly, lower-income people without adequate education and connections are competing for a smaller and smaller slice of the economic pie. If there was ever a good time to offer affirmative action based on family income, giving kids from lower-income families extra consideration in college admissions, for example, it's now. Despite the fact that one of the great social achievements of the last quarter century is the emergence of a black middle and professional class, people of color are still overrepresented among the poor and working class. The advantage of income-based affirmative action is it would address many of the same issues as race-based affirmative action, but it would also address the needs of low-income whites. And income-based affirmative action would not create tensions between lower-income whites, who don't benefit from race-based affirmative action, and blacks who do. Demagogues would have a harder time using race to stoke the fires of economic resentment. Finally, income-based affirmative action would lead to more economic diversity on our college campuses. And more economic diversity is a key to reversing America's trend toward widening inequality. Income-based affirmative action makes sense. Democrats, as well as Republicans, should consider it.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. You won't see him at the convention, but you ought to know he's endorsed Barack Obama. You can send us your thoughts. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. One of the great parts about doing this show in Los Angeles is this, a weekday morning, 10:30, sitting in the hotel pool on top of the Standard Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, talking to Kevin Pereira about waterproof gadgets and devices. You have had me on this program singing, playing music, and now here I am talking with you about fun electronic toys you can
take
in the water.
But come on, standing in the 3.5 deep heated pool
on a rooftop,
it's not as bad as the audience booth, right?
A little embarrassing, perhaps.
It might be embarrassing now, Kai, but when your listeners can go online and watch the videos of you up to 1.5 meters deep, on, you know, thanks to the Sanyo Exacti camcorder, it's gonna all be worth it.
So it's a good thing we're not in a 6-foot pool, right? Because 1.5 meters, not actually so deep.
You know, I feel like I have gone way, I mean, I had this in salt water in Jamaica, underwater. We're taking videos, then we brought it to the pool, and we're doing diving shots, and then I took it out, shook it off, plugged it right into my laptop, and
how's
there was
the,
all my media.
How's the quality?
Video quality is great.
Is
records
it really?
In MPEG-4 format. I mean, it's not quite high def, but it's more than enough for your YouTube videos.
I'm just going to take a little video of myself.
Yeah, please. In fact, I highly recommend giving yourself a, go underwater.
Oh, yeah. That's actually why. So how does it look?
All right,
let's play back. Can we do a little playback?
Absolutely. It's what I love about the X-Acti is that not only is it fun to hold, it's a nice, small, compact camcorder. It's super easy to use. There's only like 3 or 4 buttons on the face. So I'll hit play and switch it over to play mode.
Right.
There's the video that we just took. And we'll start that one off.
Remind me how much this thing costs.
This thing right now, I mean, you can find this camera for probably $200 online. Might be able to find it even cheaper.
All right, so let's say we want to do moving pictures, but just still underwater photography, some nice fishes, coral reefs, whatever it is, while we're out scubaing or snorkeling. What do you
want some 10 megapixel high quality underwater stills?
I do that actually. That's,
you can
that's
do that.
What I want.
Well, Olympus has a camera here. It's the Stylus 1030 SW. Shockproof, waterproof. This thing is all terrain. It can go anywhere.
And it will cost me how much money?
A couple $100, about $300 or $400.
And how much extra am I paying for the freezeability and the waterproofness?
You're not paying much extra. You know, you can get 10.1 megapixel cameras for $150, $200. Olympus has found their niche with this, and they said, hey, why don't we let you crush it with 200 pounds of force or drop it from 6 feet high? And camera's fine.
All right, here's what I'm going to do, though. I'm going to take a picture of myself underwater.
Okay.
Rather than have you do it. And then I'm going to mess around with it.
Now, make sure you get some of the arm in the shot from MySpace.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Facebook. And Kai has submerged himself. He smiled.
How about a half-in, half-out trip? Me and Michael Phelps, right?
Yep, you got it. That's it.
Okay, so that's...
And that's the sound of me throwing it on the ground.
There you go. Again, that's the video portion of the demonstration today. We've got some audio, too.
People love working out and listening to music, so what exercise is better than a little cardio in the pool than swimming a couple laps? So this is a device by H2O Audio. There's so many different cages. There's OtterBoxes, and there's all sorts of companies that make waterproofing devices. But what really matters is you got to find a cage that's designed for the device you're using it with.
Right.
So what we have here is their iPod Nano case.
So let's give the radio description of this thing. It's clear polyethylene. It's the size of an index card, basically.
It even comes with a little arm band there, so you can strap it to yourself.
That's exactly what we're going to do.
Throw on some waterproof headphones, which do not, sadly, come with the case.
No, they don't, but you know what? We're going to try the regular one.
Yeah, you're going to get a little shock. I think
you'll
get a little jolt.
You think I am?
I don't know.
It's death cab for cutie. All right, we're going to try this thing actually just floating around in a while.
Still got audio.
Nice.
Yeah.
Doable.
I think. I don't know. It's a little weird. So this obviously, in addition to being waterproof and all that stuff, would be sand and beachproof as well, right?
Yeah, that device can go anywhere you want.
And so a little box like this cost me how much?
About $80 retail.
About $80.
And there are 1,001 companies that make waterproofing devices for iPods. I mean, that's the beauty of the iPod being so ubiquitous.
All right, Kevin Pereira, G4 Television, attack of the show. Thanks, Kevin, for coming out and doing a little swimming.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Do another one? I should have thought to say this while we were out at the pool, but we've got the pictures and video that Kevin and I took on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, in which corporate America gains an appreciation for the phrase, the check is in the mail. CFO Magazine and the consulting firm REL did a study of how long it's taking America's biggest companies to get paid by their customers. The wait is up a day and a half to about 41 days on average. And we're not talking here, for the most part, about you and me sending payments to JCPenney or Sears. Most of these are business-to-business sales, and analysts at REL say the longer payment periods are just a reflection of life in the credit markets in 2008. Customers trying to hang on to their cash as long as they can before sending in that check. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bounced up 89 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ climbed 20 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 clawed up 10 points, also 0.8%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, elephants, Africa, and the economy.
Every single animal in South Africa has a commercial value on its head.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.